You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
On Aussie prisoners of war in the First World War. You may have heard the term kill or capture, either in pop culture or perhaps you've been given this mission yourself. Prisoners of war have been covered in pop culture from Hogan's Heroes through to The Great Escape. What a motorcycle that was. Even Big Carl himself was a prisoner of war for a while. In fact, that's where he got his hatred of the French language and French cuisine. But what about the Australian experience on the Western Front in the Great War? Were many Australians taken prisoner by the Germans? And if so, how were they treated? I'm back at the Australian War Memorial, and between grabbing a coffee at Poppy's Cafe and taking selfies with Anzac Parade in the background, I've managed to find the most suitable guest to answer these questions. My guest today is Aaron Pegram. He's a historian in the military history section at the Australian War Memorial, where he specialises in the First World War. He's a historical guide and tour leader for the memorial's battlefield tours to the Western Front, and is currently completing a part-time PhD on Australian prisoners in Germany during the Great War at the Australian National University. Aaron, thanks for hosting me here at the War Memorial and coming on the show for a chat.
Thank you very much, Mick, and it's thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Aaron, as I said before, you're a historian at the Australian War Memorial, which it seems about half my listener base actually is at the moment, which is actually pretty impressive. I have over 12 listeners. But not too many people would know what a historian does at the Australian War Memorial. I'm sure we've all got lots of thoughts. And there's also probably a lot of people that are thinking, you know, how do I become an Australian War Memorial historian? Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your work?
Okay, so as you said, I'm a historian at the Australian War Memorial, and we differ a little bit to the usual run of historians that you've had on the show so far, because I would consider myself a public historian. I don't have a teaching load. I don't need to write material and publish frequently as such, but the role of the public historian is to really engage with the public, and that's really what we do here at the Australian War Memorial. It's a museum, it's a shrine, and it's also an archive. So the historians here do a number of very different tasks. Among my tasks, for example, is working on the exhibitions. We just recently opened up our new refurbished First World War galleries for the First World War centenary. The last time that had been updated was 1984. I'm also working on current conflicts, a lot of current conflict material. We have an updated version, an updated gallery to our in our post-45 area to cover off the Gulf War, Iraq and Afghanistan. We're also involved in a number of publications. This office is responsible for publishing quarterly magazine Wartime, which has a subscription base of about 7,000 readers, and it's really intended to give the Australian public an idea of a broad range of not just Australian military history, but also global history and how the Australian experience fit within it. We've been involved in conferences. Just last week we had our 1916, The Cost of Attrition, international conferences. We had historians from all over the world come here and present papers, not to an academic audience, but to a public audience. We're involved in Last Post Stories, which Malia spoke about several weeks ago. I'm involved in battlefield tours, various research for political or for the various ministers, such as Department of Veterans Affairs, our director, Dr. Brendan Nelson, and at the end of that long list, our own research. So to sum it all up, I guess the role of a public historian here at the memorial is to disseminate Australian military history to the Australian and international public.
For those history buffs out there, it actually sounds like a bit of a dream job, because a lot of the guests, as you said, I get on the show, they are under some pretty tight requirements to teach, publish, keep their name out there. I'm sure last week at the conference, there's probably a few academics getting around. They were a little bit jealous of the role you play in the War Memorial because a little bit of the pressure is different. I won't say there's no pressure because I've been to the last post ceremonies and I know how much writing goes into each of those bios for all of the casualties, and that is quite an amazing output from the department as well. Now, you have a very interesting topic for your PhD. Can you give me just a little bit of an overview and how you decided upon this topic for your PhD?
So my PhD subject is I'm looking at the Australians who are taken prisoner in the fighting on the Western Front, and they spend the remainder of the First World War in German captivity. And I have to admit that I came to this subject due to family history. A great-grandfather of mine who was taken prisoner at Bulacore on the 11th of April 1917. And I was wanting to learn a little bit more about sort of what he had been through. And as you mentioned, my perception of captivity in Germany was Steve McQueen on his motorcycle, or, you know, Hogan's Heroes and all that sort of guff. There wasn't a book out there. So I sort of set upon questioning, why was this? We know so much about the Australian experience in captivity during the Second World War, particularly the Australian experience in the Pacific. You know, there was 27,000 Australians captured by the Japanese during the Second World War. 8,000 of them die in captivity. It's certainly the memory of that experience is very central to the Second World War. Why wasn't the case for the First? So I did a bit of poking around and discovered that, you know, there was actually quite a significant, you know, number of guys who were captured on the Western Front, you know, close to 4,000 Australians, members of the Australian Imperial Force who fall into German hands mainly through offensive operations. That is, you know, they're going up out of their trenches, attacking the Germans, and they find themselves in situations where they become prisoners of war. And the surprising thing about it is, you know, of that, you know, 3,841 Australians who become prisoners, 90% of them return home after the war. And I think that the fact that most of these guys survive and come home is a real clincher in all this, because it doesn't sort of fit the way in which we remember the First World War. You know, the 60,000 Australians who die in the First World War, and their loss becomes central to the memory of the Great War and its commemorative activities in the years afterwards. But because so many survived, it's almost, they sort of just fade out back into Australian society. There's this almost perception that perhaps their captivity wasn't as strenuous or difficult. But when you start poking around, in fact, it actually was.
Now, we're in the middle of the centenary commemorations for the Great War. In fact, it's the centenary of the Somme campaign. As we're recording this, you also mentioned there was, you know, 4,000 Australian prisoners who were taken, and how you came to understand how significant their captivity was in terms of they survived, they returned. So this is like just under 2% of the total Australian military force in the Great War. How were they treated by their German captors, and did this affect what information they may have provided?
I think the interesting thing about these about captivity during the First World War, and particularly on the Western Front, is that it's actually extremely difficult to become a prisoner of war in trench warfare. Most of the fighting, or most of the killing, and it takes place from afar in positional warfare. You know, as an artilleryman, you appreciate the fact that operations is conducted with large volumes of firepower. It's only in those very few instances where guys got to get up out of their positions and actually come face to face with the enemy that they become prisoners of war. And in the daily realities of combat operations, that's very infrequent. It's capture only occurs during patrols, raids, and those very few instances where, you know, the infantry are actually conducting attacks against the enemy positions. So in terms of the Australian experience, this really happens on sort of, there's three critical periods in which Australians are lost as prisoners: 1916, 17, and 18, of course. And surprisingly, they occur during actions where the infantry succeed in getting into the enemy positions, and they find themselves either outflanked and vulnerable to German counterattacks. When you break down the units in which these guys come from, they're the units that succeed in taking their objectives when the units around them were unsuccessful. So take for instance, Fromelles, which is the first major loss of Australian prisoners. Fromelles fought on the 19th to 20th of July 1916, and there's 470 Australians who go into the bag in one hit. And virtually all of them come from the 8th and 14th Brigades, who succeed in capturing the German positions. The 15th Brigade, which had assaulted the German fortified salient, the Sugarloaf, was annihilated by machine gun fire, which left the right flank of the Australian positions completely open. And the Germans were able to exploit this and use it to their advantage. Throughout the night, they squads of German infantry sort of make their way, find gaps in the line. They outflank the Australians. The infantry then sort of expend their ammunition, defending their modest gains. They're left unable to withdraw. And by early morning, they have no other option but to raise their hands, throw away their rifles, and capitulate to the enemy. It's a similar situation in 1917, at Bulukor on the 11th of April 1917, where you have men of the 4th Brigade who are set out to capture the German positions of the Hindenburg Line. Now, they're supposed to go into action with support with tanks. For whatever reason, these tanks are completely unreliable. The infantry would normally go in with artillery support, and the artillery support is sort of forgiven. It was given up in favour of these tanks. So the infantry is left to cross virtually a kilometre of open ground in full view of German machine gunners. And miraculously, they fight their way into the German positions, but that leaves them vulnerable. They can get in, they can fight their way, expend all their ammunition fighting in those enemy positions, but then they can't actually sort of withdraw when the time comes. And that results in the capture of over 1,170 Australians in the largest loss of men as prisoners in a single action until the fall of Singapore in February 1942. So, I think part of my research is, there's a great volume of work that looks at capture as a function of morale, men who become demoralized in combat, ultimately become prisoners. But I'd sort of really interested in actually looking at the operational value of prisoners, or reinserting prisoners back into the operational narrative. And that's how I kind of hit upon this idea of the value of prisoners to the enemy. And your question goes back to how, what sort of information, the Germans are able to acquire from Australian prisoners. The Australian war diaries are filled with excerpts from interrogation reports based on German prisoners, the examination of German prisoners. So I sort of, in terms of looking at this operational narrative, is like, what did the Germans learn from Australian prisoners? And what's interesting is that you obviously don't get this in Australian records of men who had become prisoners. They say, we were cross-examined by German intelligence officers. Don't worry, I didn't really give them any information. But of course, the German intelligence records tell a completely different story. And not necessarily men who, verbally sort of spilled the beans and sang like canaries, but prisoners didn't necessarily need to say anything under cross-examination for the enemy to acquire information from them, because they carried that information on their uniforms, their colour patches, their regimental titles. Though all that signified to the German high command that a specific unit had moved from one part of the Western Front to another, which was, of course was of immense tactical value. So the German army actually had a lot to gain from treating prisoners considerably well. And this is certainly the case immediately post-capture. Australians, like most British soldiers fighting in the First World War, sort of had believed that if they had become prisoners of war, that they would be deliberately mistreated. The German army had overrun France and Belgium, fulfilling this policy of frightfulness. They had torched libraries. They'd released chemical gas on the Western Front. There was apocryphal stories of nailing Canadian prisoners to barn doors with bayonets and all this sort of stuff. The reality was that once immediately after capture, the best sort of treatment that the Germans could afford these prisoners often resulted quite well in the intelligence game. because prisoners were lulled into a false sense of security. The fact that these men who were being treated considerably well by an enemy they believed who was going to deliberately mistreat them, you know, sometimes giving them cigarettes and glasses of cognac, was all that was needed for prisoners to openly talk about military operations.
That's interesting. There's a few lessons that have come out of that that answer you've given, particularly, you know, don't know how many times I have to say it, but if you don't have artillery support, just don't do it. What I do find interesting is, and this might be, you know, instrumental for my own way forward, is that, you know, success doesn't always breed triumph. What a way to be rewarded for making gains no one else did than to be captured by the Germans. But then again, if you look at the next stage of that, if you're captured, you're more likely to survive. Well, maybe being captured wasn't such a bad thing, especially if they'd give you some nice high-priced cognac as well. Now, you talk about the intelligence they gave up. They wear the intelligence on their sleeves, so to speak. Probably carried it in their papers. This sounds like the sort of thing that you would want soldiers to be aware of. You know, make sure you understand that what you wear and what you carry on you, if you are captured by the enemy, could be an issue. Now, we know they probably weren't expecting to be captured by the enemy. They were expecting to either win and live or, you know, die on the Western Front. It was mass mobilisation of the Imperial forces as well, so there weren't the training regimens that we have in modern day for all of these soldiers. In fact, there weren't the training regimens that regular armies had at the time for all of these soldiers. There was also a lack of Microsoft PowerPoint, which is fundamental to the instruction of the modern army. What I would like to know is, were they given counterintelligence or, you know, the modern term of operational security training?
The short answer to that is yes, they were, but none of it was specific to what would happen or what were their obligations if they became prisoners of war. The field service regulations and the notes for infantry officers, for example, they gave explicit instructions on how to handle and process enemy prisoners of war, but they didn't delve into any information about what was expected or how to act under cross-examination in German hands. So the interesting thing is that when the first Australian soldiers who were captured in May 1916, they don't have any of this training, that they're not the benefit of any of this particular training. And so when they are examined by German intelligence staff, they openly and freely discuss operational matters. Now, we only have those reports, the German reports that were compiled afterwards. There isn't any records of the conversation had. But, you know, you get the impression that perhaps there was a bit of a confidence trick there, and that the Germans, you know, had indeed sort of treated these guys well enough, and these guys had just been through the ordeal of combat. They were somewhat relieved. But you get some very engaging insights into what prisoners speak about when they've been through that ordeal of capture. You know, they're probably fearful for their lives, or just glad to be away from the smoke and cordite. In May 1916, there's a German raid on the Australian positions at a little place called Libredeau, which is outside the town of Armentières. And it's actually the first Australian action on the Western Front. It takes place just before Fromelles. And the Germans conduct this raid, and they capture 11 Australians as prisoners. They make off with two then top secret Stokes mortars. The battalion in question, the 20th Battalion, never really lets that down. But there's the Australian officer who's wounded in that action and is carried back over to German lines. It actually spills the beans. Lets the Germans know that there is a major operation in the north coming, and that ultimately becomes Fromelles. He also discloses the location of the 2nd Division defences. He makes comment on the names of various commanders in the Australian forces. So, you know, that's actually quite significant. But of course, he's also captured with a photograph of a portrait of himself and another soldier. In fact, I've actually got that photograph on my wall over here. And that is that photograph is then circulated to German units all throughout the front to graphically illustrate how Australian soldiers visually look different from their British counterparts. It's not until after, around September 1916, that the Australian forces and indeed the British Army as a whole starts recognising that guys who fall into the hands of the enemy become something of an operational liability. And the British Army as a whole then instructs its men on what is required of them if they became a prisoner of war. And it was simple. Don't say anything other than your name and your rank. And that was pretty much it. Because if men tried to sort of give the enemy the slip by giving them false information, such as their regimental details or anything like that, they could actually hamper the notification process that was in place for the Germans to inform the Red Cross that these men were in fact not killed, not missing, but in fact prisoners of war, and could then delay the receipt of Red Cross food parcels, which in the context of German captivity is extremely vital, because Germany is undergoing extreme economic hardships during the First World War. It's got over 2.5 million Allied prisoners to care for, and they're able to defray some of the economic costs of maintaining those prisoners through the receipt of allowing the Red Cross to send food parcels to prisoners. So it's quite an interesting little sort of aspect of captivity, which we perhaps as Australians, or British Empire, of course, may not have actually considered in terms of the prison war experience, what value they are to the enemy who captures them.
It's a fascinating point about that particular officer who was wounded, and looking at your photograph here on the wall and the German pamphlet that seems to have been handed around afterwards for those listeners that can't see it. And I would assume most of my listeners, apart from Aaron, can't see it because you're not in the office with us right now. It is a hand-drawn sketch covering off on the two gentlemen in the photo with all their equipment and some measurements and details on what the equipment is to highlight the differences between the Australians and other Imperial troops. It's quite an illustrative illustration on how one can take a seemingly innocuous piece of personal information, which is obviously this portrait of this guy and his mate, or in British terms, this guy and his mucker, and it has been turned into an intelligence product for the enemy forces. The impact of prisoners of war economically on Germany is probably an aspect people don't consider, and the Red Cross food parcels, I suppose, is very much, or care packages, is very much illustrative of how it was beholden upon the Germans to play relatively nicely with the prisoners as well, because the prisoners brought in that commodity, which, as we know, the events that happened politically in Germany a little bit later on, any sort of economic benefit that the German government could have for its people at the time was important. Now, Aaron, we've talked a little bit about, how that profile... Aaron, we talked about that photo and explained how that has become that intelligence product. There's also the concept of wearing your intelligence on your sleeve. Now, I'm unsure if this is a confirmed rumour or not, but I have heard in the past that Frommel had been blown. I'm not sure if blown's the right term, but the intelligence some Germans had gathered off a prisoner led to them understanding the point of the Frommel feint. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I'm always mindful that we have international listeners, so I'll just sort of give you the the bullet points of Frommel and what it was all about and what the intention was. This was the Australian 5th Division had arrived in France from Egypt. It was a newly raised formation, had been in France for just 2 weeks before it was committed to its first major operation. And in fact, it was the first major offensive operation conducted by the Australians in France. And it's detached from 2nd Anzac Corps and is attached to British 11th Corps in the north for an operation where it would be joining the British 61st Division in a feint against the German positions outside the village of Frommel. Now, the purpose of this was to get the Germans to think that there was a major offensive action being planned in the north and pin their reserves in the north instead of having them be sent south to the fighting which was then raging on the Somme, which was the focus of British operations. That was the real game. So the inexperienced Australians fighting alongside the equally as inexperienced British 61st Division are to capture a series of German trenches outside Fromelles astride a fortified salient known as the Sugarloaf. And it's a costly disaster. It results in over 5,500 Australian casualties in less than 24 hours. It's a big failure. It's huge. Now, among those 470 Australians who are taken prisoner is a fellow by the name of Captain Charles Mills of the 32nd Battalion. Mills was a company commander. He had fought it out with German troops in the German positions with about 20 of his men. In the exchange, he's wounded in the hand. Gives a pretty good account of himself in combat. They're taken to a collecting station behind the lines, and Mills is sort of gets his hand cleaned and bandaged. But what's interesting is Mills takes with him a diary. And during the initial pat down and search for intelligence material, the searching intelligence staff come across this diary, and it contains the full the whereabouts of the 5th Division or the 32nd Battalion and what it had been doing since it's arrived in France. So that was interesting on its own right. There was also a photograph of Mills, a photographic portrait, which much like the one that's here on my wall, was kept to assist in the visual identification of Australian troops. But the big clincher was the orders, the 5th Division orders from General Sir Richard Haking, which specifically stated that the attack was designed to pin the Germans in the north, while the main effort was being raged down to the south, and to prevent those German reinforcements being sent down to the south. Now, none of this is documented in the Australian records. The Australian official war historian Charles Bean says that the Germans did come across this intelligence from an Australian prisoner. In the German records, it's said that Mills, once this had all unfolded, Mills said it was a serious error of judgment to allow such an important document to fall into their hands. So the game is up. The Germans know that that Fromelles is nothing but a feint. But the surprising thing about it, though, is that those reserves do remain in the north. They're not transferred further to the south. So while Mills has a serious indiscretion, he's not the benefit of any counterintelligence training or anything like that. So we can't sort of blame him for that effort. But the Germans do retain their troops in the north. So I think that makes a really interesting point, is that while prisoners can disclose operational matters, it's up to the enemy, of course, to enact on that, which is a completely different matter entirely. But the fact remains that prisoners of war, irrespective of nationality, bring with them into captivity important intelligence information, which can be of immense benefit in the conduct of operations.
It's a fascinating case study in military deception. For those who have read some of the stuff I've written on book reviews regarding military deception, one of the things you never understand until after the fact is exactly what your enemy is going to do. When it comes to military deception, you need to try to aim to understand what you want him to think or her to think, but what he's going to do is left entirely up to him or her. And this is a good example where they may have even believed that this written order from Mills may have been a double bluff. And for those people writing orders where you're doing divisional and corps level feints, don't give those orders to the people that are conducting the feint in written format that they can put in their diary. It's an interesting concept with military deception. Sometimes you don't tell the force they're the deception force in order to safeguard the information itself. Aaron, this has been a fascinating discussion about a topic that I think personally and some of my listeners don't really know enough about or understand. We look forward to more work. Hopefully, once your PhD is finished, you can then roll it straight into a book and we can find it where all good books are. But it's not the end of the show, because The mission on the Dead Prussian is to understand war through many different lenses. We are framing the debate and discussion on war, just as Big Carl sought to frame the debate and the discussion on war. And as part of this discussion and part of this framing, we need to understand what the definition of war is. Now, Carl couldn't quite pin it down in his lofty tome, even with his wife's help, who, by all reports, was much smarter than he was. I know that's true in my case as well. But now, I invite you, one of our most affable guests on this show, to offer a definition and frame the debate. War is?
For me personally, a purely academic exercise. I've never worn a uniform. I've never been under fire. And as such, I don't feel qualified in any way, shape or form to try and pin down what war is or isn't. But I do see its long-lasting consequences on a daily basis. You know, like my colleague Malia, I see war as justified and necessary, but I also feel humbled to work with people who have been through that experience, people who have, you know, highly trained in their profession, who go to war so that the vast majority of civilians don't have to. It's for me, war is, it's haunting, costly, and tragic, and you really get that when you are talking to the father of an Australian soldier who has been killed in operations in Afghanistan, or an elderly woman whose son was lost during an ambush in Vietnam, or you get it when you're trolling through documents relating to an Australian soldier who survived the Great War by being in a German prisoner of war camp, only to discover that he didn't survive the peace and took his own life. War is an extremely complicated, multifaceted human experience. And from where I sit, I see it. It's extremely humbling to meet those men and women who wear the uniform, who've been through that experience, and who come here to the memorial to share their experiences.
Well, I think I've found about four definitions within there, but the one I truly like is that war is haunting, costly, and tragic, mainly because it fits really well in a tweet, and we can drive some marketing of this episode with it. Not that I'm just about building up the listener base or the iTunes reviews. Now, Aaron, you've recently edited a book. It's not quite as lofty as the one by Klaus Sitzer's wife. It is Beyond Surrender: Australian Prisoners of War in the 20th Century, and it's edited by Joan Beaumont, Lachlan Grant, and Aaron Pegram. I encourage all our listeners to get out there and search on any online bookstore or walk into any decent bookstore. It's a Melbourne University Press publication, and check it out because you might just learn something about prisoners of war in the 20th century. I know that I've definitely learned something today. Aaron, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right, listeners, make sure that you swing by your podcast app, either Stitcher, Podbean, Libsyn, or I do hear of this thing called iTunes. And if you've just been to the store and find yourself with some stars in change from buying the milk, maybe throw five of them our way, and then we can broaden our audience base. The more people talking about such an important topic and broadening this debate and conversation about war means the more our society reflects upon it and the decisions revolving the lives of our young men and women that will eventually have to fight these wars. Until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian podcast is written, produced, and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons attribution license. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.